Hey, good evening, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for joining the program tonight. Thanks for joining anything. Go join something. You feel better if you do. Join our podcast subscribers. Before we get cranked here, Kathy has an announcement about the community at MikeMalloy.com. Kathy?
We've had a lot of people ask where the chat room is.
And I can't answer it.
And the answer is it's in the Malloy online community. And you go to the main page and you log in, and then you'll have a bunch of links there after you've logged in. And one of them says Malloy community, and it's in there. It's in the chat's in there. We hit it.
What?
We had to make it. Well, it's only a quarter. You got to dig for the rest.
All right, I'm going to try to get in there tonight during the breaks, perhaps a little later in the program, to say howdy to everybody, and also just to see if I can do it. I have no idea how to get into the Malloy online community. I don't have a clue. Do I need a password? Do you have a password?
You're so cute.
You know,
but Mike did figure out the Google before the former president did.
I did figure out the Google. I wish that I were perfectly at ease with President Barack Obama, because every time this guy gives an address like similar to the one he gave today, I get completely lost in his words. I see rainbows. I see doves flying. I hear beautiful music, sounds of the celestial spheres gently dinging in the cosmic breeze. I mean, this guy, Barack Obama, really makes me want to believe. He does. The rhetorical power of this man is, I don't know. We've not seen anyone like this. Certainly not in my lifetime. No, not Kennedy, not Reagan. No. Barack Obama is so far ahead of those two, who are usually mentioned in the same breath, as though there is some kind of a triumvirate that knew how to move the American public. Barack Obama knows how to move the world. And it's astonishing. I get flashes almost, of pride. You know, I want to stop people on the street and say, hey, that's my president talking. Isn't that cute? My wanting to do that. Oh, you'd think at my age, right? Do me a favor, though. Don't send me any emails pointing out to me how he has failed here and he's not kept that promise and he hasn't done this and he hasn't done that. I'm acutely aware of all that. I really am. That's what sets up this incredible conflict, you know, this cognitive dissonance that just ricochets around inside my punkin little head until I feel like I'm going to scream. I hear him give a speech like the one he gave today, and it calms me down, you know, for a couple of weeks. It really does, regarding my attitude about his actions as president so far. And then within a week or two, you know, the doubts start to creep in again. When I start, you know, getting back to the real world, or what I think is the real world, maybe not. Maybe Barack Obama lives in the real world, and I am out here in beyond the pale, somewhere wandering around the rocky steps of no confidence, discouragement. You know what I'm saying? I know you get there sometimes, too. I'm sure you do with this guy. But during the afterglow of one of these speeches, I just am stunned. He plays his audience the way Yasha Heifetz plays a Stradivarius, doesn't he? He just, it's unbelievable. If it weren't too tacky of an expression, I would say that he had the Muslim world nibbling from his cupped hand today during that speech. I watched, I listened, I went to various global websites to check the reactions of people in the Muslim world, from Indonesia all the way back to the Middle East, and oh sure, there was a lot of people who have a political slash religious axe to grind. Had reserved comments or negative comments about what they heard. I'm talking about people in the Muslim world. But the Muslim street, as the pundits always like to talk about, was blown away by this guy. Blown away. You know, when you stand up in Cairo, an American president, and your skin is dark and your middle name is Hussein, and you say assalamu alaikum in order to get the program going, what's not to like? It was pretty incredible. He, New York Times says he opened a bold overture to the Islamic world today. New York Times says he urged Americans and Muslims to drop their suspicions of one another and vigorously confront violent extremism. The New York Times says he pledged to pursue a two-state solution to the Middle East peace that is in Israel's interest and Palestine's interest. There are all sorts of entrails to read here and signs and portents. He is the first president in a long time to refer to Palestine. Usually, cautious, cowardly American presidents talk about a Palestinian state, which is so much more ambiguous than saying Palestine. He talked about Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And he reserved some of his sharpest words for Israel and called for an end to settlements in the West Bank, so saith the New York Times. He called Cairo the timeless city, knowing full well that the Egyptians have been co-conspirators in our long, dark night of torture and rendition and lies and deceit. But he called it the timeless city, which it is. He spoke for 55 minutes to an audience at Cairo University. His remarks were televised and translated around the world. I heard on NPR this afternoon that his speech was translated into, I believe the commentator NPR said, into 55 languages. Unbelievable. The New York Times says his message was sweeping and forceful, at times scolding. He invoked the Holy Quran, the Talmud, and the Holy Bible in a speech filled with historical references. At the beginning, the New York Times says the president strode onto the stage to loud applause and a standing ovation. He conceded that his appearance came at a time of great tension between the United States and Muslims around the world. A couple of things he did that I specifically like. He never mentioned the name of George W. Bush. He never used the word terrorism. He presented himself as a new face of American leadership. He mentioned the fact that he was a Christian American whose father was an African Muslim. He mentioned that he had lived in Indonesia as well as Kansas. Was it Kansas, Kathy? I think it was Kansas. He went on and on and on. And the most, one of the most important aspects of his speech today, he was also the first sitting American president to have the decency and the courage to admit U.S. involvement in the 1953 coup in Iran, which overthrew that country's democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh. He acknowledged it, but he didn't go on to say the obvious. And I understand why. I mean, you don't do this. You don't say, oh, and we installed the Shah, and we immediately helped him set up a secret police terrorism organization of torture named the SAVAK. Now, you don't go that far. But he did say, quote, in the middle of the Cold War, the United States played a role in the overthrow of a democratically elected Iranian government, end quote. And that's the first time a sitting U.S. president has publicly admitted involvement in that coup. I cannot, you know, write this guy off. I can't. I continue to be impressed with the progress he makes, with the attitude he carries, with his brilliance, with his rhetorical power. And I continue to be disappointed and upset about certain things that I thought were going to happen that haven't happened yet. And maybe that's the key word, yet.
Every time I turn on the TV, there's hope. Somebody's acting crazy, there's hope. Let it, it'll drive you crazy, there's hope. But I'm taking back my power today, there's hope. Gas prices, they just keep on rising, there's hope. The government, they keep on lying.
Liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
Standing tough under stars and stripes, we can tell this dream's in sight. You've got to admit it.
21 past the hour. Yeah, Obama is, and I realize the cynics out there are going to email me and say, well, Malloy, there's more to running the country than making great speeches. Yeah, that's true, and I'd be the first one to stand at that line of cynics. I really would. But I still am constantly amazed at the confidence that he shows, the presence that he owns, the ability to move gracefully through this firestorm that a series of U.S. presidents has created on this planet. I'm amazed. That's all. I'm amazed. His ability to not come across as patronizing, to not come across as though he represents this evil dominant force on the earth that everyone has to respect no matter what the evil dominant force does. And that, of course, was the approach that Bush and Cheney and so many presidents have taken. The attitude of we are the United States. We will kick the living hell out of you. We will overthrow your government. We will kill your people. We will destabilize your economic system. You will do what we say. That's been the attitude of the United States for over 100 years. And at various points in that 100 years, that attitude has been more pronounced or less pronounced, but that has been the attitude. Barack Obama does not present that face. His approach, his rhetoric is even-handed. It's not conciliatory. These are not the words of someone who stands on a stage like he stood on today fearfully. He seems to be extremely centered, extremely in charge of not just his thoughts, but his presentation too. I'm sure that the right-wingers will say, well, he read another speech off the teleprompter. You know, screw the right-wingers. They are meaningless. They are just a pain in the collective ass of the United States. They really don't matter, only to the extent that progressives, Democrats, liberals, normal people, let them matter. But Obama's speech today, there are way too many religious references for me, except when I consider the audience to whom he was speaking. That address was mainly targeted toward, you'll pardon the word, toward Muslims, toward Arabs, toward people who have come to rightfully despise us, absolutely despise us. You know, the courage of Barack Obama to walk into, as Daniel did, oh my God, he's talking the Bible, the lion's den, and understand his audience to the extent that he could say the things that he said. While he was not patronizing or condescending, he certainly wasn't conciliatory. He made the points that he wanted to make, where it concerned the non-democratic ways of so much of the Muslim-oriented world. without turning it into insults. He stated facts. You know, I was listening to some of this today. I tried to imagine. I tried to imagine. Oh God! You know, George Bush doing something like this. I know. Forget it. It was just a moment of self-inflicted pain. You know, trying to think of George W. Bush carrying on a conversation or a lecture or a speech about anything. What a dumbass! And this, you know, Obama's speech today brought into sharp relief for me this astonishing difference in the Democrat, educated, present Barack Obama and the Republican, uneducated, dry drunk that ran this country as a figurehead for the past 8 years. The comparison is just breathtaking. So, again, the conflict, the whole damn thing sets up in me is just, Mr. President, if you would just stop fudging on some of the things that you said when you were a candidate, if you would take some of this righteous realism that you seem so well armed with and apply it to the United States, to our foreign policy, to the situation in Afghanistan, to the situation in Iraq. And his choice of words today about Iraq being a war of choice, I was waiting for the auditorium to crash down on everybody's head. A war of choice. Did you catch that? Or did he call it a war of opportunity? I don't think he said war of opportunity. I think he said war of choice. Afghanistan, he called legitimate. I certainly don't agree with that. But conflict, 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 right? When we come back, we're going to play some cuts from his speech today. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This whole mercy for me. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Lost now. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby by the night. Oh, mercy, mercy, mercy. It is 25 before the hour. All right, Barack Obama today in Cairo. You know, he really is the worst nightmare of the terrorists who have so far in their activities against the United States in reaction to our activities against them have the terrorists have counted on American presidents, most recently Raisin Brain, to take a with us or against us attitude, which always helps the so-called terrorists grab new recruits. Obama reaches out to the Islamic world with an open hand instead of a carpet bomb. And voila, Al-Qaeda no longer has that George W. Bush, Dick Cheney recruiting tool.
So long as our relationship is defined by our differences, we will empower those who sow hatred rather than peace. Those who promote conflict rather than the cooperation that can help all of our people achieve justice and prosperity. And this cycle of suspicion and discord must end. I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world, one based on mutual interest and mutual respect. And one based upon the truth that America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition. Instead, they overlap and share common principles, principles of justice and progress, tolerance and the dignity of all human beings.
Wow. That is so not Dick Cheney. But that is a clear example of what I was talking about. He is not being conciliatory. He's being respectful. He's not being patronizing. He's approaching the Muslim world as an equal, forcing the so-called Muslim world that is religiously backward, as far as I'm concerned, as far as a lot of people are concerned. Of course it is. You know, as long as a society or a group or a cult or a religion or whatever dresses their women head to toe, and I know how I'm using the language, just relax, dresses their women head to toe in what looks like grill covers, for Christ's sake, and forces them to walk around peering at the world through little mesh screens, that cult or religion or culture or society is absolutely ass backwards and dumb as hell, in my opinion. But Barack Obama sees beyond that. And I'm glad he does. Obama continues his attempt to mend the damage to the American image in the Muslim world, done by not just the Bush crime family, but by every president going back to whom? Woodrow Wilson? This time, he quotes from the Quran. Can you imagine George W. Bush quoting from the Quran? Or even pronouncing it correctly?
No single speech can eradicate years of mistrust. Nor can I answer in the time that I have this afternoon all the complex questions that brought us to this point. But I am convinced that in order to move forward, we must say openly to each other the things we hold in our hearts, and that too often are said only behind closed doors. There must be a sustained effort to listen to each other, to learn from each other, to respect one another, and to seek common ground. As the Holy Quran tells us, be conscious of God and speak always the truth. That is what I will try to do today. To speak the truth as best I can, humbled by the task before us, and firm in my belief that the interests we share as human beings are far more powerful than the forces that drive us apart.
Wow. I mean, he says, in order to move forward, we must say openly to each other the things we hold in our hearts and that too often are said only behind closed doors. Oh, my God. That wild applause you heard after he quoted the Quran, that was the sound of applause. It was also the sound of terrorist cells shrinking. And immediately after that, when he says, when he quotes, be conscious of God and speak always the truth, he said, that is what I will try to do. I will try to do. Speak the truth as best I can. I will try. You know, not listen to what I'm saying or I'll put a goddamn nuke up your ass. He doesn't say that, does he? He says, I will try to do that. Tell the truth as best I can. And then he uses the H word. Humbled by the task before us. He says he is humbled. Humbled? An American president? A six-shooting, by God, I will nuke you. I will take your oil. I will stomp in your face. I will overthrow your... What? Humbled by the task before us. And he says, firm in my belief that the interests we share as human beings are more powerful than the forces that drive us apart. Wow. I can't wait to have you tell me, because I won't listen, how the right-wing pissants tear those comments apart. Huh? I'm sure they're working on it tonight. I'm sure that on Hannity's program tomorrow, following Limbaugh's, because Limbaugh is Hannity's boss, there will be all sorts of deconstructions, parsing of what Obama said, so that the right-wing filth that dominate the airwaves can point out to you Obama's cowardice, Obama's being willing to be stepped on, Obama's refusal to fight terrorism. But just for tonight, we know the truth of what he said. He then spent a large portion of his speech praising Muslim accomplishments, from mathematics and algebra and science to pens and printing and disease prevention to poetry and art. I remember, most of that stuff happened while Northern Europeans were crawling around inside of caves worried that God was going to come down and rip their goddamn heads off. And then he promised to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam in America, stating that Islam is part of America. Can you imagine Bush, Cheney, John Bolton, Negroponte, any of these killers saying anything like that? Islam is part of America? Obama then turned toward our illegal war in Iraq.
Unlike Afghanistan, Iraq was a war of choice that provoked strong differences in my country and around the world.
Wow.
Although I believe that the Iraqi people are ultimately better off without the tyranny of Saddam Hussein, I also believe that events in Iraq have reminded America of the need to use diplomacy and build international consensus to resolve our problems whenever possible. Indeed, we can recall the words of Thomas Jefferson, who said, "I hope that our wisdom will grow with our power and teach us that the less we use our power, the greater it will be." Today, America has a dual responsibility: to help Iraq forge a better future and to leave Iraq to Iraqis. And I have made it clear to the Iraqi people, that we pursue no bases and no claim on their territory or resources. Iraq's sovereignty is its own. And that's why I ordered the removal of our combat brigades by next August. That is why we will honor our agreement with Iraq's democratically elected government to remove combat troops from Iraqi cities by July, and to remove all of our troops from Iraq by 2012.
And the applause went on and on there, another bad sign for the terrorists who are languishing without W. You see, this is the kind of talk from Obama. Oh, I know. The political pundits who are much smarter than I and you will tell us that the speech doesn't mean diddly squat. And the people on the real left in this country will tell you that he has not gone far enough, that what he should have done is stood there in Cairo and said, "I am ordering all the troops out tomorrow. We're sending over 17,000 Greyhound buses to pack everybody up and take them to Kuwait." And I know that people on the far right will go the other extreme and say he is a Neville Chamberlain. He is selling out everything that 4,000 American soldiers have died for. But tonight, we can listen to what he has to say and marvel.
through a hole in the air from those nads in Tiananmen Square.
It's the Mike Malloy Show. You are now entering exactly a flying monkey free zone.
Real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the
10 before
ashes
the hour. I hope our wisdom will grow with our power and teach us that the less we use our power, the greater it will be. Thomas Jefferson, wow. His statement that Iraq was a war of choice was another one of those moments where you've just got to stop and smack your forehead and say, did he really say that? Did he really say that? A war of choice? I mean, in the first place, a war of choice means it's a violation of the UN Charter. There's no such thing as a war of choice. But this was his way, I believe, of putting the responsibility for the death and destruction in Iraq on the two people with whom it most rests. And both of them have the name Bush. And, of course, sandwiched between the two Bushes was Bill Clinton, who, with his Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, decided to continue the sanctions so that hundreds of thousands of people, mostly children, would die. Now, that's not something that the people in the Middle East generally, or the people in Iraq specifically, are going to write off with one great speech. It's not going to happen. But in calling it a war of choice, Barack Obama put the truth where it needs to be. The attack on Iraq was a war crime. The first attack and the second one. And the 8 years, 9 years of sanctions in between, we committed an almost 15-year-long war crime, 16, 17-year-long war crime against the people of Iraq. When he says the Iraqi people are ultimately better off without the tyranny of Saddam Hussein, the key word is ultimately, because they're damn sure not now. No, I understand. Barack Obama had his torture rooms too, didn't he? And some of the people tortured were tortured for sport for his two psychopathic sons, who were not all that different, when you get right down to it, from Dick Cheney, John Negroponte, John Bolton, David Addington. Oh, well, why go through the list? You know what I'm talking about. Obama reiterated his vow to stop, quote, enhanced interrogation, end quote, and to close Gitmo, again knocking the wind out of the sails of would-be terrorists. And then he moved on to Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Obama reinforced the longstanding America is a friend of Israel line, and then made this controversial statement acknowledging the suffering of the Palestinians.
It is also undeniable that the Palestinian people, Muslims and Christians, has suffered in pursuit of a homeland. For more than 60 years, they've endured the pain of dislocation. Many wait in refugee camps in the West Bank, Gaza, and neighboring lands for a life of peace and security that they have never been able to lead. They endure the daily humiliations, large and small, that come with occupation. So let there be no doubt, the situation for the Palestinian people is intolerable, and America will not turn our backs on the legitimate Palestinian aspiration for dignity, opportunity, and a state of their own.
Excuse me while I find mucho falto with that 53-second sound clip. The Palestinians have suffered in their pursuit of a homeland because, well, they had one, see, until the Jews from Europe and South America and the United States arrived and pushed them out of their homeland. And as far as the statement, for more than 60 years, they have endured the pain of dislocation. Well, because of what I just said, there was no reason for the Palestinians to be dislocated. It was their country. Well, okay, you know, unless you accept that God gave it to the Jews thousands of years ago. He went on to say, many wait in refugee camps in the West Bank, Gaza, and neighboring lands for a life of peace and security. Refugee camps. Why are they in refugee camps? They were pushed out of their own villages, their own country. I don't care how you try to rationalize it. I don't care if you want to go to the guilt, the enormous guilt that the world shares for what happened to the Jews over the course of the diaspora. If you want to believe in the diaspora, the Jewish diaspora, the slaughter during World War II and the death camps, or if you want to fall back on the, well, God gave it to them riff. The Palestinians were occupied in the same way that the Iraqis are being occupied. And he says, America will not turn our backs on the legitimate Palestinian aspirations for this and that and the other. Is there an illegitimate Palestinian aspiration? Supposing we were invaded by a massive force of Native Americans who came from some other planet. You know, redskins with feathers and bows and arrows. And they said, we want our land back. Get the hell out of here. What would be the non-legitimate demands of the Native Americans? What are the non-legitimate demands of the Palestinians? I need somebody to clear that one up for me. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. Kate was in Phoenix today, and she emails me, overheard a right-wing nut this morning say, quote, I've never seen anyone walk off of Air Force One not wearing a tie, end quote, as apparently Barack Obama did. Kate writes, evidently it was the worst thing they could say about the Egyptian trip. I turned the dial quickly. Nice speech, she writes, compared to W, but I still don't believe a word. Big difference between rhetoric and policy. I don't want any more of our babies dead. May the politicians all rot in whatever is hell. Kate, yeah, that's probably the proper attitude. I fluctuate between that and being swept away by the rhetoric. I admit it. I'm a fool for poetry. That kind. I'm a fool for rhetorical waves of what? Or should I say I'm a fool for waves of rhetoric? I don't know. If it's the right kind of rhetoric. When I listen to old recordings of the usual gang of tyrants as they gave their rhetorical drum beats and flourishes, I'm not swept away. Even though I don't understand German or I don't understand Russian, or I don't understand French, not at the rate that it's being spoken, most of it not at all anyway. But I can tell by the cadences. I can tell by the expressions on the face of the speaker. I can tell by the waving arms and the almost stunned silence of the people who are listening until the cue is given for them all to raise their arms or applaud or whatever it is they're going to do. With Obama, I don't get that sense. I just don't. I get a sense of a young man struggling. Maybe struggling against something that it's just pointless to struggle against. Something that is a century and a half old and way too big for him. But I get the feeling that he's going to try. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe not. Again, I look at the things that I assumed he promised during the campaign. That I want to see it. I want to hear it. I want to see the actual this or the actual that. I. And I admit that. And I guess it's because I have spent so many years, whether it was a Democrat or Republican in the White House, is frankly immaterial. So many years of listening to this pro-corporatist right-wing garbage. And I keep hoping, probably in a futile way, hoping that somebody is going to, before I die, assume the presidency of the United States and do good by doing the proper thing. And I keep hoping it's Barack Obama. Maybe not. Back to the speech in Cairo. He then laid out his vision of two separate states, Israel and Palestine. And I find fault with a lot of this, but we're going to play it anyway for you.
The Palestinian Authority must develop its capacity to govern with institutions that serve the needs of its peoples. Hamas does have support among some Palestinians, but they also have to recognize they have responsibilities to play a role in fulfilling Palestinian aspirations, to unify the Palestinian people. Hamas must put an end to violence, recognize past agreements, recognize Israel's right to exist. At the same time, Israelis must acknowledge that just as Israel's right to exist cannot be denied, neither can Palestine's. The United States does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements. This construction violates previous agreements and undermines efforts to achieve peace. It is time for these settlements to stop. And Israel must also live up to its obligation to ensure that Palestinians can live and work and develop their society. Just as it devastates Palestinian families, the continuing humanitarian crisis in Gaza does not serve Israel's security. Neither does the continuing lack of opportunity in the West Bank. Progress in the daily lives of the Palestinian people must be a critical part of a road to peace, and Israel must take concrete steps to enable such progress.
Oh boy, that last part, Israel must take concrete steps to enable such process, that's going to make that's going to make so many mini minds in this country, Jew and Gentile, brand him an anti-Semite for shizzle, huh? Don't you think? In this minute 50-second comment, he says the Palestinian Authority must develop its capacity to govern with institutions that serve the needs of its people. How is that to happen, Mr. President? The average Palestinian can't travel 30 miles on a highway without going through checkpoints. The average Palestinian has watched his ancestral farmland or grape orchards or olive trees ripped to pieces. The average Palestinian over the past 50 years has watched as every single institution that Palestinian has tried to establish be knocked to pieces, literally by Israeli bulldozers and tanks. How, Mr. President, is the Palestinian to develop its capacity to govern when it lives under these conditions? How? He says Hamas does have support among some Palestinians, but they also have responsibilities. Do we not also have responsibilities regarding Hamas, Mr. President? Did we not push the Palestinians into an election posture where Hamas happened to win in Gaza? And what have we decided to do since that win? We have withheld absolutely critically needed funds. The Israelis have denied the people of Gaza access to their own bank accounts in Israel. Hamas has responsibilities. Indeed, it does. How can they fulfill those responsibilities, though, Mr. President, unless the United States assists? He says Hamas must put an end to violence. Well, everyone wants an end to violence. At what point does an occupied people say, we give up? We're not going to resist any longer. Is that not what this violence is all about? Or is it just open season on Jews for the past 50 years in the Middle East? Is that the case? I know there are people who believe that, or 60 years, I should say. Of course there are people who believe that. But the sad equation between these two peoples, the Palestinians and the Jews, who, in fact, has suffered more death and destruction and damage and chaos and sickness and shortness of life and lack of jobs and lack of housing and lack of plumbing and lack of water, which between the two has suffered the most and why? Mr. President Obama, those questions need to be asked by you and by us because they're asked by the Palestinians every single moment that they're awake. He says the United States does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements. The key word in there is continued. How about the United States does not accept the legitimacy of Israeli settlements? And if he were to say that, even putting in the modifier, continued Israeli settlements, what are we left with? A great big uh-oh. Uh-oh, Netanyahu was probably watching this speech, throwing little rubber darts at his television screen. As Obama said, the United States does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements. Why not the United States does not accept the legitimacy of any Israeli settlements? Because we are talking about settlements in occupied territory that does not belong to them.
There is a season, turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to gain, a time to lose, a time to rend, a time to sow.
Primal Scream, you suppress, embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
Past the hour, going back to that last soundbite where Obama lays out his vision of two separate states, Israel and Palestine, he says that it's time for the settlements to stop, which, of course, was definitely an applause line given his audience. He also said Israel must live up to its obligations to ensure that Palestinians can live and work and develop their society. The only reason there are obligations is because Israeli government or the Jews who move there are an occupying force. That's why they have obligations. What is this obligations? We have obligations in Iraq because we are the occupying force. The British had obligations in Northern Ireland because they were the occupying force. What is Obama saying here when he says that Israel must live up to its obligations to ensure that Palestinians can live and work and develop their society? What does that mean? Is it a patronizing sort of obligation? The what we used to call, or historians used to call, the white man's burden? As Europeans went around the earth conquering here and slaughtering there and filling this with disease and that with the with crazed Christianity, we had a burden, the white man's burden, to bring truth and justice and God and all kinds of nonsense to the pagans. Right? Is that what he's talking about? If he wants institutions developed by the Palestinian Authority that serve the needs of its people, if he wants the Palestinians to be able to live and work and develop their society, then does it not precede all of that, that the Israelis have to withdraw? They have to go back to the pre-1967 borders and allow the Palestinians to have one contiguous state. What is this West Bank, Gaza? Have you looked at a map of this tortured part of the world? Have you looked at a map? Can you define the borders of a nation state by breaking it in two after you have moved into it and occupied it, after you've claimed it historically as your own, that you were forced out by forces, you were scattered around the earth, and now you've come home? And do you find some sort of rational approach to what you do with the people who are there when you come home? Is it rational to say, well, here, you can have this piece and you can have that piece? We can have this settlement and that settlement. We can have a two-state solution. So the Syrians and the Egyptians and the Jordanians attacked Israel, not the Palestinians. And as a result of that attack, the Golan Heights were taken. The Sinai was taken. The West Bank was taken. Jordan wised up, signed a peace agreement, absorbed hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Palestinian refugees where they still live. Egypt was finally bought into the equation with the signing of Jimmy Carter's peace treaty with Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin. Syria? Well, Syria. But the Palestinian people, what have they done? What have they done? At what point do you tell an occupied people that the resistance must stop, that they must accommodate the people who invaded their country? And again, I so much of my thinking about that was influenced by Rabbi Meir Kahana, an absolute radicalized Zionist who truly believed that the only good Palestinian was a dead Palestinian. And I've said this before in his book, They Must Go. He laid it out fairly clearly about the Palestinians who watched the Jew come from Warsaw and New York and Caracas, Kiev, Moscow, and claim this land as their own. And Kahana said, of course, the Palestinians are going to resist. Of course they are going to fight. Of course they are going to try to kill every Jew they see. Of course they are going to do this. And that is why, Kahana said, The Israelis must butcher them all, murder them all, dump them all into the ocean. Now, at what point are the Palestinians supposed to say, okay, we're rolling over, notice our legs are up in the air, we're all dead?
Peace, salam, shalom, we believe in peace.
Go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. Arguably, President Obama was never more effective during this speech than when he said these words.
Too many tears have been shed. Too much blood has been shed. All of us have a responsibility to work for the day when the mothers of Israelis and Palestinians can see their children grow up without fear. When the holy land of the three great faiths is the place of peace that God intended it to be. When Jerusalem is a secure and lasting home for Jews and Christians and Muslims, and a place for all of the children of Abraham to mingle peacefully together. As in the story of Israel. As in the story of Israel, when Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, peace be upon them, joined in prayer.
Wow. If you are a religious person, if you are one of the three religions of the book, what he just said there is borders on profound, doesn't it? And I'm not being a smartass. I understand that there are a lot of people who do believe in their religion and are not murderous psychopaths. They perhaps are not necessarily in the majority when you get right down to it. But sure, there are Christians, Jews, and Muslims who historically, at various times in their religious histories, have mingled peacefully together. And one of the disrupting forces of that peaceful mingling, of course, was the Inquisition, which also was an instrument of one of these three religions, right? So it wonderful, absolutely wonderful that Barack Obama can approach this from the position of someone who does, who is a religionist, and he is. And certainly everyone in the so-called Muslim world by definition is a religionist. And certainly the people who established the modern state of Israel are religionists. So perhaps Barack Obama can bring all of these religionists together. I doubt it, because it is not the nature of these three religions to tolerate each other. It is the nature of these three religions to want to kill each other. Good luck. Obama spent the next portion of his speech speaking about the dangers of a nuclear-armed Iran. He said his vision was a world without any nuclear weapons. He did not mention a nuclear-armed Israel, which to people in this country, the United States, means nothing. To people in the Muslim world, so-called, it means everything. He said his vision was a world without nuclear weapons. That's a good vision to have, isn't it? He supported Iran's access to nuclear energy, and then he moved on to democracy, stressing that America would never impose our form of democracy on any nation. Really? Do we get a do-over where it concerns Iraq? Do we get a do-over where it concerns Central America? Do we get never mind. But he welcomes any who want to join our form of governance. And then he spoke about the importance of religious tolerance of all faiths in economic development. And finally, he concluded with a renewed call for unity.
There's so much fear, so much mistrust that has built up over the years. It's easier to start wars than to end them. It's easier to blame others than to look inward. It's easier to see what is different about someone than to find the things we share. But we should choose the right path, not just the easy path. There's one rule that lies at the heart of every religion, that we do unto others as we would have them do unto us. This truth transcends nations and peoples. The Holy Quran tells us, O mankind, we have created you, male and a female, and we have made you into nations and tribes, so that you may know one another. The Talmud tells us the whole of the Torah is for the purpose of promoting peace. The Holy Bible tells us, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. The people of the world can live together in peace. We know that is God's vision. Now that must be our work here on earth. Thank you. And may God's peace be upon you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, I feel like Moldar. I want to believe. I want to believe. The quotations from Torah, Quran, and the Bible is, on the one hand, certainly a stroke of, in this situation, in this, in the context of this speech, a stroke of genius on the part of whomever wrote the speech. And I understand that Barack Obama writes his own speeches with an enormous amount of help from a couple of talented, very talented speechwriters, one of whom I believe is only 28 years old. But never for a moment assume that Barack Obama does not write his own speeches, because he does. He has assistance, obviously. You don't whip out something like this. It requires a lot of work. But in the context of the people to whom he was speaking, and this speech pretty much was directed at two audiences, the larger and more important of the two audiences were the Muslim world. The secondary and certainly not important, except for whatever political reasons might exist back here, the speech was directed towards his opponents in the political system that is rotting from the core in this country. For those people back here, it was strictly in your face, strictly in your face, acknowledging the overthrow of a duly elected government in Iran in 1953 by our CIA by the sitting president was a massive kick in the ass to the right wingers and the CIA freaks and the clandestine killers and corporate America, because that was nothing more nor less than an overthrow of an elected government for corporate satisfaction. His references to Palestine. fall pretty much in that same category. His use of the term that the war in Iraq was a war of choice. All of these were directed primarily back home. They were acknowledgments to the primary audience, the Muslims. They were certainly acknowledgments, and they were historic in that sense. What American president has ever walked into Cairo or Damascus or pick a city and said, yes, in 1953 we overthrew the duly elected government of Iran? Who's ever said that? So he gets, doesn't he, gold stars for that, and he gets the applause, and the applause is legitimate. And I hope that this president can follow through. When we come back after this break, there's one more quote that I want you to hear, and I think we can find it. If we cannot, then I'll just read it to you. But it's a quote wherein he uses a word that no other president has ever used where it concerns the Israeli-Palestinian situation. And again, we'll try to find it in this speech and see if we can pull that particular sound. If not, I'll just go ahead and read it to you. But but I think it's important that we hear it. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. How many people never get a chance to shine?
To listen to Right Wing Radio, here's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. All right, I want to play for you again one of the sound bites we played of Barack Obama's speech just a few moments ago, but it bears repeating because he uses the word occupation as I pointed out in parsing his words. It's very difficult to pursue, as he put it, a homeland when you are occupied. I mean, how do you do that? How do you do that? How do you do that? You wind up in either reservations or refugee camps. Is there a third choice? And that homeland, the reservation or the refugee camp or the Bantustan, is not one that you choose. It's one that the occupier forces you to accept. And if you don't accept it, very simple, you will be killed. So the word occupation that never slips from the lips of any American president in the past that I'm aware of, that word is spoken by Barack Obama, and I'm sure that the gates of hell will now open on that part of the speech, and through those gates will rush those who insist now that Barack Obama must be an anti-Semite. He has been called everything else. Once again, here's the quote.
It is also undeniable that the Palestinian people, Muslims and Christians, has suffered in pursuit of a homeland. For more than 60 years, they've endured the pain of dislocation. Many wait in refugee camps in the West Bank, Gaza, and neighboring lands for a life of peace and security that they have never been able to lead. They endure the daily humiliations, large and small, that come with occupation. So let there be no doubt, the situation for the Palestinian people is intolerable. And America will not turn our backs on the legitimate Palestinian aspiration for dignity, opportunity, and a state of their own.
Remember, during the Reagan years, where it concerned the system of apartheid in South Africa, the white domination of that entire country, their passbooks and their Bantustans, and the daily humiliations that Obama's referring to here for the Palestinians were in place for the black South Africans. They would be allowed to come into the white enclaves and work for Madam or Mister, you know, clean the houses, carry out the garbage, you know, that sort of stuff. But at night, they had to return under penalty of imprisonment, which usually meant severe beatings. They had to return to their Bantustan. They had to get out of the white enclaves, even though by historical rights, it was their country. During the Reagan years, when apartheid was accepted, corporations in this country had no business or had no problem doing business with Botha, the white man who ran South Africa. That's the way it had always been as far as American interests were concerned. It has always been white South Africa that was in control. But Ronald Reagan came up, or someone advised him to come up with a policy of, what did they call it? Constructive engagement. To engage constructively. How do you do that? With an occupier, with a dictator, with an organization, a political organization that says to the people who actually are indigenous to the land, we're going to do business with the occupier. The people that are denying the existence, the legal rights, the human rights of the indigenous population. We're still going to do business. We're going to call it constructive engagement. So while I am impressed, I am deeply impressed with what Barack Obama had to say today. We've got his entire speech is available all over the internet. And when the program's over tonight, I'll put the headphones on and lay back in bed and listen to the entire thing again. Because it was an amazing speech. Did it go far enough for me? No, of course not. But that's a relative statement. It went further, I think, than any speech by any American president has ever gone. Yeah, the usual qualifiers are in there, the usual signposts about our unbreakable bond with Israel. You know, demanding that the Palestinian people recognize the state of Israel. How do you do that? How do you demand? I mean, it's one thing to exist in occupation, but how do you demand that the occupied people recognize the legitimacy of the occupier? How do you do that? How do you say that to the occupied people? From their point of view, again, I go back to Meir Kahane and his book, They Must Go. How do you say to people who have been invaded, who have been run off their land, how do you say to them 50, 60 years later, you must recognize the legitimacy of the occupier and expect to get any kind of a coherent answer? How do you do that? You say, this is what Barack Obama This is that Gordian knot that he is trying to untie. But remember, it was untiable until someone stepped up with a sword and just whacked it in two. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. Just a program note. We intended to play for you another episode of Mike Malloy Radio Gumshoe tonight, which is ready to go. But because of the president's speech today and our focus on that, we'll do it for you tomorrow night. So don't miss it. Mike Malloy Radio Gumshoe, written and produced by Bob Alexander, presented by the Mighty Malloy Radio Players. It's a hoot and a half. Phone lines are open. The number is 877-996-2556. If you feel like calling in this evening, we'd like to kind of sort of maybe focus on Obama's speech today or aspects of the speech that you want to address. 877-996-2556 is the number. Len is calling from New York. Len, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. It's been a long time since I called.
Yeah, you haven't. I've missed hearing from you.
Yeah, well, my schedule changed for a while, and I sat back and tried to digest all of the events of last year. About a year ago or so, I thought the most important event for the year to determine who's going to win would be what Muqtada al-Sadr did. And boy, did a lot of other things happen.
Uh-huh.
So, I took off my analyst hat for a long time, and I've been sitting back here, and as you know, I'm an Orthodox Jew here in New York,
mm-hmm.
and I was listening to the speech, and I was telling people for the last 6 months or so that, we're not going to get any kind of dialogue started until somebody acknowledged that we overthrew the Iranian government in 1953. And, it was great, to see him stand up there and say it.
Mm-hmm. And also to acknowledge that Iraq, our involvement there is a war of, what do you call it, war of opportunity? Or
War of choice.
War of choice.
Yes. In fact, I breezed through Mark Levin's book, and I wrote a review on Amazon this evening after I was listening to him for a few minutes, and he was incensed that he called Iraq a war of choice.
I'll bet he was.
And my response to anyone who denies that, as I said, you have your place right next to Holocaust deniers.
That's a good place to put him. What is your take on Barack's statements of the Palestinians living under an occupation?
Well, a lot of people don't want to acknowledge that it's an occupation, but, it is. I mean, you can debate where the borders should be. But whatever part of the West Bank that's under their gun is occupied. So, my old favorite expression was, if Bill Clinton had not had term limits and Yasser Arafat had, then the world would have looked different by now.
But it might not have been, seriously now, I'm not joking here, Lynn, it might not have been the way your envisioning it.
Well, you know, back then, from everything we sort of heard, you know, there was a willingness to trade. In other words, there were settlements there 8 years ago that were across the 1967 Green Line.
Right.
That apparently Ehud Barak had been willing to trade that the land that they took there for other land, probably not quite as lush and bountiful. But remember, a lot of that place is relatively uninhabitable without the modern technology to clean it up and desalinate and everything. So they were willing to do that, apparently. And, you know, the exact four, you know, like the number 97% was there, like they were 97% of the way there. But, you know, Arafat was just not the kind of guy who wanted to actually resolve any problems. And that was a certainty. We know that. That's another certainty. So here we are 8 years later after somebody figured out that, you know. And let me just go back. In 1974, I was 20 years old. And in 1974 and in 1975, I hitchhiked my way through Israel, and part of that hitchhiking was through areas now which would be considered unsafe for anybody without, you know, without a tank to go through if he were Jewish.
Right.
So there was no, you know, desire to kill anybody who walked past, you know, an Arab home or an Arab store back then. And people don't recognize the function of time in creating the pent-up anger of being denied, you know, just legitimate rights. Back then, nobody really figured out that, you know, a two-state solution was the necessary resolution.
That's a good point, and it's one that's I think completely lost on so many people, especially here. I asked you this once before, and if I remember, I must have asked you this a couple of years ago. One night when you called in, and after you had said that you're an Orthodox Jew, I think I said to you, "Well, then, you do not recognize the state of Israel because it was not founded by the Messiah." And I forget what your answer was.
Well, there are arguments as to how the rebuilding of Israel should occur, whether or not it's actually the people's action that brings the Messiah, or the Messiah that brings back the people. And that's Talmudic debate also.
Right.
But, you know, when I say that people are in such a hurry to say, well, you know, we really can't, you know, give up areas, you know, I respond to them and I say, you know, when you can buy in many, many stores all over Israel, non-kosher, in fact, pig, you know, in Tel Aviv, there are many, many, and even in other cities too, you can buy non-kosher stuff. I try to remind people, you know, there's a lot to clean up here, you know, that you're trying to extract the religious when it's comfortable for you and deny the stuff that really is non-religious. I say there is arguably no other homeland that the Jewish people can claim. At the same time, there were borders in 1967 that were pretty much agreed to, and you know it's a question of having the ability to make a deal. I mean, you know, people around here, because of Jimmy Carter's book, you know, Palestine, what was it called? Palestine something, or Apartheid?
His last book that caused so many Jews on the board of the Carter Center to resign. Yeah.
The title was talking about the West Bank. It wasn't just talking.
Right.
It wasn't talking about Israel proper. And, you know, I try to remind people that, you know, there are guys who managed to create the peace treaty with the potentially biggest enemy of Israel that's on its border.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I hear now, I don't remember the name of the guy who's running against Ahmadinejad. People forget what the whole purpose is. You know, I have a number of notes written down. People forget what the main purpose of this speech was. I don't know if you ever read any Vince Flynn books.
I have not.
Vince Flynn writes these great stories about a CIA operative called Mitch Rapp.
Mm-hmm.
Mitch Rapp is the guy who walks into a building and finds the terrorist that actually has to get tortured or squeezed to get information with a ticking time bomb. I guess like Jack Bauer, but I never watched that show.
Yeah, nor have I. Len, I hate to tell you this because I always find you very interesting, but we are out of time here and I've got to move on. Call in more frequently if you would, all right?
Sure thing.
All right, take care. Thanks a lot for your point of view. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Hey, Truth Seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. Len added that the point of the speech might have been to marginalize the extremists by speaking rationally. And that's... In relative terms, that is a very fair assessment, and I'm not trying to denigrate what Len said in that quick email follow-up, but by saying in relative terms. But nothing can be spoken about the Middle East except in relative terms. I think we can agree on that. If after 60 years that we have been involved with this seemingly endless bloodshed and conflict, I think it's safe to say that things are never as they appear to be and that everything is spoken in a relative sense. There are no absolutes where it concerns the Middle East, so-called, the Israeli-Palestinian issue. There are no absolutes. There cannot be. And those who claim the absolutes are the ones who are the aspects of the conflict that are popularly referred to as the radicals. So while there can be no absolutes where it concerns the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and you understand what I'm saying, I hope, for the parties concerned, it's all relative. For the observers, it's all relative. For the parties concerned, of course they're absolutes. The Israeli position, the Likudnik, the Likud party, their position is absolute. So many Israelis, the position is absolute. This is our place. The Palestinians, the position is absolute. This is our place. But everything is spoken in relative terms by those who either for righteous reasons or non-righteous reasons seek to end the conflict. It's all relative. Our technical advisor, Ben Birch, is on the phone calling from Elgin, Illinois. What's up, Ben?
Well, you know, listening to this speech, one thing occurs to me, you know, and you talk about whether one can actually ask the Palestinians to recognize Israel, given what they're going through now. I don't know if an American president could make a speech like that and not include verbiage like that if, in fact, he wanted to remain the American president and remain on this planet as a living human being. Because if Mossad believed that the policies of the United States were going to change to where the United States would become a threat to the existence of Israel, I just don't think that they would allow that to happen.
I'm sure a lot of people would agree with that, with what you just said. Any absolute proof of that in an historical sense over the last 60 years, is debatable. Not in the way you're saying it, but in the sense that I understand that others who have threatened Israel's existence are no longer with us. What immediately comes to mind is the very tenuous position that Iran is in right now. Right now, as we're talking, Netanyahu could decide that, okay, the time is now, boom, and Iran is devastated by a nuclear attack. Of course, I think Netanyahu still maintains a grip on reality and understands what that kind of an attack would result in. I think he understands that. I hope he understands that. But as far as an American president, do you really think, and this is not a challenge, just a question, do you really think that those forces in Israel who would not tolerate such a thing would not tolerate it from an American president?
Yes. I think that they would not. I really do believe that if it looked bad enough, if it looked like an American president were arguing that, in fact, there ought to be return to the 67 borders, that, any number of lines that could be crossed would be so unacceptable to the power structure of Israel that they would have to do something to change that policy by whatever means possible. And there really would, given resolve on the part of an American president, be only one way to change his policies.
Well, that's a pretty scary scenario, but I hear what you're saying, Ben. Trust me, I do. Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate you calling.
You take care.
All right, you do the same. Ben Birch, who is our technical advisor and never calls in, but there he is. We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
No religion.
Just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
I'd welcome the chance to meet my maker and fly into the sun. Fly into the sun. Fly into the sun.
It's about 25 before the hour. This is the Malloy program. we had on the rundown for tonight's program a bunch of stuff, including the 20th year commemoration or anniversary, I hate that word, where it concerns the slaughter of what happened in Tiananmen Square, 1989, in Beijing, China. My take on that, or my recollection of that, is found in the blog, today's blog at MikeMalloy.com. So if you want to check that out and comment on it, feel free to. Also, there were several other topics that we are simply not going to get to tonight, which is fine. We will get to them tomorrow night. So just an acknowledgement that the massacre at Tiananmen Square 20 years ago did not go unacknowledged on this program, because we, I addressed it at the website, MikeMolloy.com, if you want to read it. Jeanette is calling from St. Paul, listening on KTNF. Hey, Jeanette.
Hey, Mike. I hope you can forgive my lack of comic timing here, but I've been trying to get through since early in the program last night.
Oh, my goodness.
And this was the first time I could get through. Somebody told you last night that you'd be more effective in your critiques if your language was cleaned up.
So
I want to lie to complain that the program isn't vulgar enough.
Well, it's about the best we can do, given the fact that it goes over the air. If this were an internet program only or Sirius XM only, I might be able to loosen up a little. What?
Yeah.
What? You're not loose already? But
the best person that I've heard deal with criticisms on radio is Stephanie Miller.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. People call up to complain on her show. She gets a lot of complaints, for example, that they're not serious enough, and why don't they get serious?
Right.
And they usually respond with lots of slide whistles and fart noises. So she's brilliant at it. What she does is if somebody calls in to complain, she just barrages them with whatever they're complaining about.
She's quite the gal. I really, really, really like Stephanie Miller.
Oh, me too. Her in the morning and at night. I can't live without either one of you.
I hear you.
But what I really called about, and I've mentioned this before when I've called, you mentioned before you're a fool for poetry.
Uh-huh.
And I just am dying for you to check into a guy named John Trudell. There's a DVD just called Trudell. It's a documentary about him.
Mm-hmm.
Jackson Brown, Kris Kristofferson, Bonnie Raitt, the Indigo Girls, Robert Redford, they're all on the DVD.
Ah, Trudell, T-R-U-D-E-L-L?
D-E-L-L, yeah.
Okay.
If Truth Seeker was in the dictionary, his picture would be there.
Well, I will...
He's a visionary, he's a poet, and he mentions on the DVD that the primary conflict of our time is between religion and spirituality.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that.
And he calls religion the trinity of the chain, guilt, sin, and blame.
Ooh.
You will love this guy. I'm serious. You got to check him out.
I've just written it down, and I'll get to it as soon as I can. Listen, Jeanette, thank you. I appreciate you checking in, okay?
I love you. Thanks to you and to Kathy. And by the way, the music recently has been just awesome.
Well, that's all Kathy's doing. Take care.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Robin is listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Robin, welcome to the program.
Yeah, glad to be here. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, and the issue you were talking about before the break with the Israeli and Palestinians, I can agree with you that the Palestinians are victims. There's no doubt about it.
Right.
But I tend to believe that through the decisions of long-dead leaders such as Truman, Churchill, De Gaulle, Stalin, the Jews didn't have a whole lot of choice but to move there either. So you've got two groups of people who need a place to live, and the powers that be shoved them together and said, fight it out. And we're still dealing with the aftermath of that.
Mm-hmm.
And all the bad things that have happened since then are two groups of innocent victims trying to survive in the same land.
The political reality of what you're saying, I think, is obvious. Are you okay? Did something just fall over?
Oh, I'm just going through a bad signal area. I might lose you.
Oh, okay.
If I do, I'll just hang up.
The only thing, let me put you on hold for a moment, Robin, because that noise is starting to drive us crazy here. The disproportionality, is that a word? The disproportionality of between the two sides. I hate to put it that way. That thoroughly disgusts me. But it's late in the evening. I'm trying like hell to get my thoughts together here. But the disproportionality, that is certainly an identifier of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, the Jews and the Palestinians, the Jews and the Muslims, although the Palestinian Christians are there too. So let's say the Jews and the Palestinians. The disproportionality of what they both bring to this struggle is part of the problem. The Jews of Israel have established a clear connection, a very valuable connection, among the leading governments of the Western, so-called Western powers. Now, there are critics within those governments, certainly the governments of Germany and France and Italy and the UK, the various countries within the UK. There are very few critics in this country. But the Palestinians, on the other hand, with a few notable exceptions in Europe, seem to have very few friends at all, and no one to support them. So the disproportionality of this conflict, and then if you take it out of that arena and put it into the area of the conflict itself, the actual physical conflict, that disproportionality is horrendous. And as a result of it, there is no military solution whatsoever for the Palestinian people. There can only be a political solution. And I think that is the part that drives the Palestinians to madness. And keep in mind, they have been occupied for 60 years now. There are Palestinians who are in the fourth generation of living in concentration camps. And I use the term deliberately, concentration camps. Call them refugee camps if you will. But they are a concentration of Palestinian people forced into situations that you and I would not tolerate. How would we not tolerate it? If it were in what we consider to be our country, and we were invaded in our point of view and occupied in our point of view, we would take up weapons. We would resort to resistance, which in some quarters would then be called terrorism. The situation is almost unsolvable. During the British Mandate, remember what the Irgun and Haganah and the Stern Gang, Jewish underground terrorist organizations, in order to drive the British out, to get them the hell out, the car bomb was invented. And it was not invented by Lebanese or Irish Catholics, or it was invented by the Jewish underground in Israel, before it was Israel, in Palestine. So this old saw that one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter is absolutely true. As horrible as it is, it's a true statement. It's a true statement. That's what I was trying to say a few minutes ago. Everything in the Middle East is relative, except to the head-to-head, face-to-face combatants. And then it's absolute. Get out of my country, is what they both say. Get out of my country. So, if Barack Obama or Moses or Jesus or Muhammad or anyone can find a solution to that, get out of my country. Two groups of people saying the same thing, staring at each other. If anyone can find a solution to that, I think that solution would be welcomed, not just by the people involved, but by the whole world. We have a break coming here, so stick around. When we come back, we will get a couple of more calls in. I'm Mike Malloy.
On the news tonight, the unobtrusive tones on the news tonight. And mama said, Why don't the newscasters cry when they read about people who die? At least they could be decent enough to put just a tear in their eyes. But Mama said, it's just make-believe. You can't believe everything you see. So baby, close your eyes to the lullabies on the news.
Before the hour. Thanks to our crew, Kathy Bay, Ben Birch, Sharon Gordy, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Bruce Enberg, for another Sterling Malloy program. Again, tomorrow night we will cover some of the topics we missed tonight, which is pretty much all of them, and also bring you another episode of Mike Malloy Radio Gumshoe, written and produced by Bob Alexander and performed by the Mighty Malloy Radio Players. And you don't want to miss tomorrow night's Mike Malloy Radio Gumshoe. Just trust me on that. Okay? Paul is calling from Canton, Georgia. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you, Mike?
Good, how are you?
Pretty good. I was thinking that in my opinion, I believe the state of Israel should exist in the 67 borders, but I also think things are a little bit simpler. I mean, Israel doesn't have very many natural resources, doesn't produce much. They're mostly supported by us. If we stopped funding so much of this, none of this would be happening. They wouldn't be able to build settlements. They'd have to go back. Most of it, I think, is because of us.
I think Israel is more self-sustaining than you might be aware of at this point. You're right. I think Israel remains the number one recipient of, Paul, I hate to tell you this, but I have to put you on hold because there's a hum coming through your phone that is going to blow the transmitter here. I believe Israel is still the number one recipient of U.S. foreign aid. I think either Egypt or Colombia. Colombia is number two and three. They're interchangeable pretty much. But Israel is, I don't know. I would tend to agree with part of what you're saying, but I don't think Israel relies on the, what is it, roughly $2 billion that we provide in foreign aid. Maybe it's not quite that much. Plus, a lot of that foreign aid that we give them is they turn around then and buy the most sophisticated American weaponry that they can buy. Of course, they are getting pretty damn sophisticated at building their own weaponry. So, there is more to Israel than just a reliance on American foreign aid. There truly is. But I appreciate what you had to say. Thank you, Paul. Jonathan is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good.
Listen, Mike, I don't want to argue or anything. By the way, I want to make it very clear that I do not think Barack Obama is an anti-Semite. I agree with everything he said today. I would have preferred not to have had a quote from the Book of Esra at the end of his, but it's neither here nor there. It is a lovely quote, if one can, or passage, if one can believe it. But I wanted to clarify, this is my understanding, that the founders of modern Zionism were, in fact, to my knowledge, atheists, who were influenced by the Dreyfus Affair in Europe, where they realized that a member of a nearly aristocratic French-Jewish family, which had the most barely Jewish veneer, was suddenly wrongfully convicted, and I believe Dreyfus was executed for treason, and they realized that even if Jews converted in Europe, they could not survive. the other things I wanted to mention is you sound to me as if someone who actually believes that Arabs are aboriginal to the region from the Pyrenees to Persia, and they are in fact not aboriginal. All of North Africa is really originally the land of the Berber, and who are still to this day, much like our American Indian, treated like crap by the Arabs, second-class citizens. So I just don't think things are quite as simple as what I view as the typical Romanist take on Palestine-Israel. And I'm very surprised, because I certainly know you're a lapsed Romanist. But I do want to say...
No, I was never that.
Oh, then I apologize. Okay.
No. My people were all Protestant, believe it or not, even though we're Italian and Irish. Don't ask.
Wow. See Malloy and
No, I understand. No,
no.
A lot of people feel
bad for being presumptuous.
No, that's okay. A lot of people make that assumption because of my name. Sure.
But I did want to say that if you're going to cite a piece of crap like Meir Kahane, who was a piece of unadulterated crap, then please let's cite. Oh, and by the way, I do want to mention that up until the early 19th century, Jerusalem was a majority Jewish city. Also, Meir Kahane should have mentioned, and I don't know why a piece of crap like that didn't, but because he's an idiot, that the anger that Arabs in Palestine felt was also due to hundreds of thousands of people pouring in Jews pouring in from Yemen and Baghdad and other Arabian lands where they had lived for 2,000 years, al-Dini, which is as second-class citizens. Furthermore, and then I'll shut up, if you're going to cite Meir Kahane, you got to cite two things. One, that regularly from about 1880-something to the 20s, when Jordan became Jordan and took half of Palestine, which was then known as Transjordanian Palestine. Jordan is basically half of original Palestine. So basically through that period, there were regular demonstrations throughout the cities of Palestine that Arabs...
Jonathan, I hate to do this to you, but we must leave the air. And I realize that you're in the middle of a sentence, and I deeply apologize. If you'll call back in tomorrow's program or Monday's program, we'll pick it up there. I'm Mike Malloy. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit.
Did you catch the...